Welcome to The Reason Podcast. I'm Todd Cranin. Should social media platforms like Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube remove only those speakers who make true threats or incite violence? Or do they have an ethical obligation to hold their users to a higher standard? Those were the topics of a public debate recently hosted by the Soho Forum, pitting Thaddeus Russell, author of A Renegade History of the United States, against Ken White, a defense lawyer and author at the legal blog PopeHat.com. Russell argued that corporations that accept tax breaks and public subsidies should be more accountable to the public. White held that social media sites deserve the same set of speech rights and limitations as ordinary citizens. Both speakers agree with the broader libertarian point that private websites have the legal right to do what they want. This debate hinges on a broader point. What should the culture of free speech, free expression, and ownership look like on our social media platforms? The debate was held November 1st, 2018, at Reason Studio in Culver City, California. Nick Gillespie moderated.
The Soho Forum is a monthly debate series held in Manhattan that is moderated by Gene Epstein and co-sponsored by Reason. It features topics of special interest to libertarians, and the series aims to enhance the social and professional ties of people within the New York City libertarian community. Thanks to Tom Yengst, we are trying a West Coast Soho Forum here, so hopefully we'll have that same experience. So, as many of you know, we're celebrating 50 years of Reason this weekend, and let me start by thanking you guys for your support and interest over not just the years, but the decades. We can't do what we do without your help, without your interest, without your readership, so please give yourself a big hand. And what I'm going to do now is I'm going to explain the proposition under debate, the participants, the rules of the game, and we'll go from there. First, I want all of you to pull your cell phone out and go open your browser and go to SohoVote.com. We're going to take a second here. SohoVote.com. You can vote? Yeah, please vote. And you're going to see, when you go there, you're going to see a screen that says it has the proposition and it's the pre-debate vote. This is what is called an Oxford-style debate. So we poll the audience before and after the proceedings. And the winning side is the side that has pulled more people to its position. So the proposition is, like universities, social media platforms such as Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube should only remove speakers and participants who are making true threats or inciting violence. Take a vote, yes, no, undecided. And we're going to let those tabulate for a little bit. And while we're doing that, then we're going to close the voting and we'll come back to it afterwards. But please do go to SohoVote.com and enter what your position is starting out. So we are debating whether or not social media platforms such as Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube should remove speakers. The two speakers tonight who I'm about to introduce both agree with the broader libertarian point that these are private platforms, so they have the legal right to do whatever they want. What we're actually debating here is, I think, something more important in many ways. What is the culture of free speech? What is the culture of free expression? What is the culture of ownership? Does tolerating noxious, annoying speech, however you define it, of jerks ruin things for everyone? Or does excluding people easily and often lead to more problems than it solves? The bloody events of just the past few weeks suggest this is a topic of vital relevance for how we think about social media, how we think about political discourse, and how we think about the real world. We've got two great debaters tonight. Defending the proposition, is Thaddeus Russell, the author of A Renegade History of the United States. He is right here. And the host of the Unregistered podcast, raised by what he calls professional revolutionaries in Berkeley in the 1960s and 70s, that earned a PhD in history from Columbia and has taught at, among other institutions, Occidental College here in Los Angeles. He's the founder of Renegade University, through which he gives lectures and talks and has seminars. Check out his site, ThaddeusRussell.com. He's also kind enough at various points to have credited Reason for helping him move beyond a kind of conventional right-left ideological divide that he grew up thinking was a given. Opposing the proposition is Kenneth White, an attorney at the firm of Brown, White, and Osborne. A former federal prosecutor turned defense lawyer, Ken is also the proprietor of the popular legal blog PopeHat, whose subtitle is A Group Complaint About Law, Liberty, and Leisure. Check it out when you get a chance. He also has an incredible Twitter feed as well. Ken hosts the Make No Law podcast, available via the Legal Talk Network, and he also appears regularly on KCRW, talking about, is it all the president's lawyers? Yes. So, like Thad, Ken also has a Reason connection. When the federal government subpoenaed Reason and gagged Reason for asking for information about some of our commenters, Ken brought this act of government bullying to the public by writing a long, brilliant piece about it. One of the, actually, I don't know for sure, but one of the, apparently somebody who got the complaint leaked it to Ken, and then he wrote a story and it took off from there. Here's how things will go tonight. Thad will speak first for about 15 minutes. Ken will respond with equal time. We're going to have a five-minute mutual rebuttal period where the debaters savage each other and ask each other questions and pretend that they can stand being in the same room with them. I'm going to ask a couple questions, then we're going to open it up to audience Q&A for 20 or 30 minutes. They'll get 5 minutes to kind of conclude their cases, and then we will vote, and then we'll finish in, you know, ransacking the taco truck outside. So without further ado, take it away, Thad. Voting is now closed. Is that right, Jim? Okay, so voting is closed. But remember to vote again. As always, vote early and vote often.
So we didn't cover all the ground rules, so I just want to, Nick, if you could clarify a few things for me, that'd be great. First of all, can I curse?
Yes.
Okay.
part of the deal.
So That's one question. Can I curse? Am I allowed to curse? The second question is, would you like for me to curse? So that's your culture of free speech right there. That's the one that you chose, and you can, and we agree on that. Let me ask you another question about ground rules in here. This is getting a little heavier. That's not me. It's pretty crowded. Can I yell fire? I see two exits, and I see about 100 people in front of me. Can I yell fire in a crowded room? According to the Supreme Court, right, Oliver Wendell Holmes in the very famous 1919 Schenck case said that that's the thing that you can't do in our society. You can't yell fire in a crowded room, right? Why? Do you remember this? There's a great Harrison Ford movie. Because it constitutes a clear and present danger to the civilization itself. Well, that's a really reasonable man, isn't he? Oliver Wendell Holmes, that sounds utterly reasonable. It'd be very dangerous of me to actually yell fire and for you to believe it and start rampaging and trying to run out the doors and everybody would get stampled and it'd be terrible things happening. Do you actually know what Oliver Wendell Holmes was referring to? What was the fire? Do you know what that case was about? You know what it was about? It was a man named Charles Schenck who spoke Yiddish, who was a socialist living in New York City, who was passing out flyers urging young men not to enlist and to dodge the draft during World War I. That's what that was about. No one knows that. So Oliver Wendell Holmes, in my opinion, not the greatest thinker in American history. Certainly not somebody who's really interested in liberty. Why on earth am I talking about this? Because I'm having a debate with this guy about free speech. I'm telling you this because it's become very clear to me in studying the history of this that it is actually always, or at least always has been, a foreign policy question. So as civil libertarians, and I'm sure this room is full of them, right? What are the four worst times in American history for civil libertarians? When were civil liberties in this country most severely restricted by the government? Or historians generally look at four times. When do you think those are? I mean, you can have your own. So they all have a couple things in common, you'll notice. So Civil War, Abraham Lincoln, what? Suspends habeas corpus and arrests thousands and thousands of people simply, and he said this, for the crime of disloyalty. He said at the time, this is necessary because secession is not, it's not bad because of slavery and racism. Secession is bad because it threatens American civilization. We must preserve the Union. It was an existential threat, the South. They believed that the South would take over the North and bring their slaves with them and destroy what Abraham Lincoln and the Republicans thought was American civilization. World War I. basically the First Amendment went into the toilet. The Schenck case was one case of that. Schenck went to prison, by the way, for advocating that young men not enlist in the military, that they dodge the draft. So Wendell Holmes was saying, yeah, he should go to prison, but other people shouldn't. World War II, right? Franklin Roosevelt effectively took control of all of the major networks and told them that they could only say certain things favoring the war. The New York Times was a propaganda wing of the federal government during World War II. Then we have people who often call the Cold War as being a nadir of civil liberties. It was really the Korean War. It was during that time when there was the fiercest restrictions of civil liberties in this country. So in all four cases, we have a war. We really have world wars, in a sense. And in all four cases, and this is really the nub of it, we had to enslave much of our population in order to fight those wars. Now, when you have to go that far, where you're enslaving your own population to go fight and die in a place they'd never been before, you need to make it really, really high stakes. So you can't allow any loose ends in those times. So those are the moments when the First Amendment went into the toilet. I think everybody agrees with that. Those were the worst times in American history. Is it just a coincidence that in every case there was a war and conscription necessary to fight that war? I don't think so. Why still am I saying this now? You may have heard of this thing called Facebook. You may have heard that just last month, Facebook deleted permanently 35 accounts, some of which were major accounts with millions of likes and followers. Does anyone know how Facebook chose those accounts? Facebook in April was brought before Congress, you may remember this, Zuckerberg and company, went up to Capitol Hill and were grilled by the senators, and basically, weren't they warned that if they don't start censoring, someone else might have to do it for them? Okay, now Mark Zuckerberg is an engineering geek and he's about 5 years old. He knows nothing about politics. And so what he did was he said, hey, oh my God, the Russians apparently have taken over our election in our country. They constitute a threat to American civilization, I've been told. And he said, well, I don't know anything about this stuff because I'm just a jackass from Harvard. A coder. How do I know which sites are actually Russian working for Putin? Well, I'll just ask the experts. So he entered into a contract with an organization called the Atlantic Council. Anyone know what the Atlantic Council is? Oh, yes, they are. They know what's best for you. They were founded in 1961 by the RAND Corporation from just down the road. RAND, famous for coming up with much of the tactics and strategy carried out in the Vietnam War, things like pacification of villages, mass murder of civilians, et cetera, and mass bombing, carpet bombings. It was the organization's purpose was to support, promote, and expand NATO. Always has been. People who sit on its board today include Henry Kissinger, Madeleine Albright, and every single person who's made a major foreign policy decision of the last 40 or 50 years. I'm not kidding you. Facebook and Atlantic Council have a partnership in which the Atlantic Council tells Facebook which accounts, which pages are threats to national security. And those were the accounts that were taken down by Facebook. Do you think the people on the Atlantic Council, all of whom pretty much were former members of the White House, cabinets of various presidents, Democratic and Republican, do you think there's a chance that those people expect to be in leadership positions in the future sometime? Do you think that they might be preparing the way for that right now? Do you think that they would like to have less criticism of their foreign policy aims right now in the public sphere? Because what they have said publicly is they want NATO to be expanded all the way around Russia. They moved it all the way to the borders of Russia, but this is public, by the way, I'm not making this up. They have said, no, we need NATO to expand to the south of Russia and then go all the way and encircle both Russia and China to make sure that they don't do bad things anymore. So free speech and war have never been friendly to each other, right? And they're always joined. And this is something that civil libertarians and First Amendment people often miss, is that's the one carve-out, has always been the one carve-out. You are not allowed to advocate anything that gets in the way of American foreign policy in the world. especially if you are attempting to discourage our boys from signing up to go fight in Vietnam or Germany or Alabama. So that's what's at stake here. This is not just about what gets to be said on college campuses. This is a core, I'm sorry if I sound like a conspiracy theorist, it's a conspiracy. It's a conspiracy. Here's the great thing, though. It's all open. What I have told you, I learned from these really radical fringe organizations called Time Magazine, Wired Magazine, Reuters. This is in the news. It's right there. Apparently, no one cares to look it up. Okay. That's one reason I would like to encourage social media platforms to allow free speech. That's not, to me, even the most powerful argument against Ken's position, though. The most obvious, easiest way, I think, to demolish that position from a civil libertarian perspective is to simply point out another fact. Facebook, Twitter, Google, all of them have received billions, that's a B, billions, tens of billions of dollars in direct subsidies and tax breaks over the last 5 to 10 years. Billions and billions of dollars. They've also been given land on which to build their new headquarters. And all you've noticed, there's a Twitter headquarters and a Google headquarters and a Facebook headquarters in apparently pretty much every city, right? In many of those cases, the land, the property was given to them by the local government. So are those still private entities? Should they just be treated like you and me in our living room? They're taking our tax dollars big time and then telling us what we can and cannot say on their social media platforms. So what I'm calling for is two things. I'm calling for a culture of free speech generally. If you're a civil libertarian, you need to be calling for it all the time, not imposing on any of these platforms or entities sort of this bullshit egalitarian thing where you have to allow free speech. I don't want to impose anything on the Catholic Church. They know what they stand for. I know what they stand for. They're totally honest about it. There's nothing secret. We know who they are. Fine. Do your thing. I'm not imposing free speech on you. I don't want to do that. But if you're going to claim to be a social media platform and you're taking my tax money, either you give me my money back or you call yourself something else. That's it. Call yourself what you are, Twitter and Facebook, which is we are centrist, globalist, imperialists. We support the center of the Republican Party and the center of the Democratic Party, and that's who we are. If you say things that are concordant with that, you can have a blast. You can say racist things. You can say sexist things on our website. You can do whatever you want. If you differ from that in any way, by the way, the 35 sites that were taken down, 35 pages that were taken down by Facebook, guess what they were? Some of those people are in this building right now. They were left-wing communist anti-war people, and they were right-wing libertarian anti-war people, all of whom were questioning this narrative about Russia having taken over our country and constituting a threat to our very existence. So I want honesty. I want you to say, Twitter and Facebook, what you actually will allow and won't allow in terms of language and ideas. And if you do honestly believe that you are running a social, meaning including all people, media platform, then yeah, you better have some free speech. And we should always be encouraging them in those moments, in those places, to welcome cursing and yelling fire, especially yelling fire. Because yelling fire, now you know, really is about saying, let's not have World War III. That's all we're trying to do. And they're not letting us say that. And they're taking our tax money. Or they're rigging the game so that they win. And they have these, isn't it amazing how they have these monopolies, Facebook and Twitter, these incredible, Google, these incredible, how did they get that? Because San Francisco and California and Oregon and Washington and Washington, D.C. and New York State have given them billions and billions and billions of dollars in tax breaks that I don't get. I have a business that's in tech, that's in media, that's in education. I don't get that. None of their competitors get that or have gotten that. They are wings of the federal and state and local governments. They are acting as their propaganda wings. That's that. Either give us our money back or be truly what you say you are. Be honest. Let's know what's going on here. And let's always be interested in speech rather than advancing a particular foreign policy agenda. By the way, I'm not saying it's necessarily a bad foreign policy agenda. I would just like to be able to talk about it in public. But they're not letting us. This is dangerous. I've always worried about war. I never in my adult life, until now, and I'm older than you think I am, worried that the First Amendment is truly in jeopardy until now. And I'm not a conspiracy theory guy. I'm always the one saying, Al-Qaeda definitely did it, guys. Calm down. I'm not the one saying, oh my God, Trump won. Oh Jesus, now Nazis, now we're all dead. I'm the opposite of that guy. This is the first time in my whole life, I've been doing politics my entire life. First time I've been worried that the First Amendment is truly in jeopardy. Quickly, 27 seconds. Two other pieces for you to be panicked about. Panicked about. Why this is so urgent. Polls taken by the FIRE Foundation for Individual Rights and Education, correct? Show that support among college students for 50%, half of all college students currently believe that the First Amendment should not protect hate speech. Okay, so some people say the people that Robbie Suave writes about, oh, they're just kids. Don't worry about it, Robbie. Stop writing about that. I used to be one of those people, by the way. I used to be a little irritated at Reason and Robbie for writing so much about those kids on college campuses. No, maybe you're not writing enough because guess what? Now we see it. We see that language in the United States Senate, right? That was a full-on attack on all civil liberties, that hearing, that set of hearings. So they're going to be in government big time, and they have no sympathy for the First Amendment. It's an entire generation, apparently. Number one. Number two, and then I'm done. The ACLU is no longer the ACLU. Do you know this? It is no longer a civil liberties union. They now have basically announced that they will no longer defend your speech rights if you have the wrong politics. The ACLU no longer exists in this country for all intents and purposes. This is urgent. And I urge you to vote yes.
Well, let me start out by repeating our proposition that, like universities, social media platforms such as Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube should only remove speakers and participants who are making true threats or inciting violence. So let me start by quoting my favorite philosopher, Hannibal Lecter, quoting my second favorite philosopher, Marcus Aurelius. For each particular thing, ask, what is it? What is its nature? What is a social media network? It's not a university, is it? As a lawyer, I can tell you that if you go onto Facebook or Twitter hoping to learn the law, you may find yourself arrested or otherwise inconvenienced, as I nearly was earlier this evening. Long story, we won't go into it now. Doctors will tell you you certainly should not take medical advice you get on Facebook or YouTube or Twitter. These are places where people speak freely, and speaking freely often means speaking foolishly and wrong. What is a social media network? It is also not the state, is it? It is not the government. A social media network is a function of a business. It's a thing to make money for the Twitters and Facebooks and YouTubes. And it is a form of speech. To quote someone who's not a philosopher, so far as I know, Mitt Romney, corporations are people, my friend, and they are. Corporations and businesses, whether it's your brother-in-law's one-person startup or the biggest company in America, also have speech rights. Those rights include deciding fairly broadly what business to be in, what to sell, deciding how to market, and deciding how to run something like a social media network. And running a social media network the way they want to run it is a speech act. If you don't believe me, I'd like to tell you about Club Penguin. How many people remember Club Penguin? So Club Penguin was a fun little online, half social media network, half online game for kids. It was a very popular way for many of them to communicate. There was the periodic fear that Al-Qaeda was using it to recruit, all the normal online social media stuff. It was aimed at 12-year-olds. It had 12 and below, I should say. It had very strict rules. No yelling obscenities, no running around waving digital dildos, whatever, what have you, because it had a vision for what it wanted to be. It wanted to be a safe and happy place for little kids. That was their speech. And the speech of the people who went there, the parents who let their kids hang out on Club Penguin, was part of it too. That was their speech and their free association. Their decision that this is the place I want to go, just as you might decide to come here tonight to hear a debate rather than someplace else debating someplace something else, just so as you might decide which bar or restaurant you go to based on the atmosphere. What we say when we say that social media networks ought to act like the state and only punish things that are outside the First Amendment is that social media networks ought to be speaking the way we want them to, ought to be associating the way we want them to. We want to dictate the way they operate. So, in effect, we're no better than the people who are dictating to them, you need to ban this speech, you need to ban that speech, you shouldn't allow hate speech, you shouldn't allow these types of threats, you shouldn't allow mobbing or bullying. All of those arguments are on a continuum. They're all about us saying how other people should associate and speak. And this is heresy in this building. The culture of free speech is bullshit. Okay? The culture of free speech, the culture of free speech is a way to elevate the argument, you shouldn't say that, you should say this. It's to pretend that when you're saying that, you are a free speech champion rather than a censor. The culture of free speech is telling people how they should associate or not associate, how they should speak or not speak, who should they allow in their living room or not. Because after all, who you allow in your living room and whose living room you go to is very much a part of who you are. It's a part of your free association and your expression. The culture of free speech, by no stretch of the imagination, should require you to say, well, I really don't want to, but to be pro-free speech, I need to let Ken White come into my living room every night and rant for a few hours about how terrible 4th edition Dungeons & Dragons was. It's creepy. It's weird. I'm really not interested. I think he's a little harsh on it, actually. It had some really innovative ideas. But, I mean, it's the culture of free speech. Of course you wouldn't say that. Because you recognize that how you order your lives is part of how you identify yourself. It's part of who you are, and it's part of your expression. It's the same with Twitter or Facebook or YouTube. The companies are deciding how to brand themselves. They're deciding how to sell themselves. Now, is it mercenary? Obviously it is. But how much human speech isn't mercenary on some level or another? McDonald's is mercenary in how they market themselves and how they portray themselves. Every business is. The market that we talk about, the marketplace of ideas that we trust to order things rather than having the government order it, operates on an individual level. What I mean is that we don't say you have to let me into your living room to rant because of the marketplace of ideas. We say that if people find my ranting entertaining, then they'll let me in to their living room. Part of the marketplace of ideas is that businesses like Twitter and Facebook and YouTube will, in the long term, in the long run, rise and fall with whether or not their users feel that they're giving them an experience that they want, whether or not they feel that they are being unfairly suppressed, whether some point of view is being suppressed and it's unacceptable, whether I can't say what I want, I can't meet the people I want, or not. And if you buy into the idea that you will never overturn the Twitter or Facebook juggernaut, I have some words for you. GeoCities, MySpace, Yahoo. We are in this age where we have 10 or 12 news cycles a day, so we think in very short term, and it's impossible to think of something like Twitter or Facebook not being the dominant social media entity. But time passes and things changed. No one says the marketplace of ideas is going to be instant. No one says that you're going to build the social media network that works the way you want it to overnight, that it won't take time to persuade people, to get other people to come with you, to patronize that business that does things the way you want. If you like fried chicken and all you have in town is McDonald's, you're going to be disappointed for a while, but sooner or later you'll get a KFC. So the marketplace of ideas says that you've got to work and gather people together and persuade people not to do the same thing, not to only talk or debate or associate the way you want to, but enough together to form a critical mass so that you have a platform, so you have other people who will, like you, have maybe Gab is your thing, or maybe Twitter is your thing. Maybe you like that it's a little harder there for them, for people to attack you with racial slurs. You will get the platform that you want eventually. That's the idea of the marketplace of ideas. Not that we will put social pressure on every platform to be the same, to have debate the same, to approach life the same. The other reason it's important to know that we're dealing not with the government or universities, but with private businesses, is that understanding the way speech works is crucial to protecting it. I join 100% the concern that many college students don't seem to understand free speech, appreciate it, or support it. But here's the thing. A crucial part of supporting and understanding free speech is being able to separate the public from the private, to separate the obligations of the different components of our society. Some of the same studies that recently found that 50% or something of students said hate speech should be illegal also found that a very large percentage of students said that if a university brings a controversial speaker, then the law should require that they give another speaker with the opposite side the same amount of time. That's a fundamental misunderstanding of the role of that institution, right? It's kind of a hearkening back to the old fairness doctrine that we've been done with for many decades. It's crucial for people to understand the difference between the public realm and the private realm and the different rules that apply. And I think we confuse them when we start to try to impose public realm norms, public realm laws, things like true threats or inciting violence as the touchstones to our private sector businesses that are expressions of our freedom of expression. The other fact is, frankly, there's no way that these organizations can do it right. We all know that. The moderation on Twitter, on Facebook, on YouTube is a train wreck. Telling them, okay, you can now, we'd like you as a social norm to let everyone on, but you can keep out true threats and incitement. You know how that's going to go. I mean, last week, Twitter was letting threats from a guy who was sending mail bombs to people across the country because it didn't detect that that was a threat, while at the same time banning people who were saying very innocuous things. Moderation on social media is always going to be a disaster because it's never going to be profitable for it to be good. It's always going to be done by bad AIs or disaffected workers, and it's going to be terrible. So a vision where it hews to some sort of principled First Amendment idea, as an example, is always going to be a pipe dream. It's always going to be, in effect, no moderation or random moderation. And it's not reasonable to expect much more than that. There's another reason, though, I think. And that has to do with support for the very concept of free speech. As Thad suggested, the support is not as strong as it could be, and maybe it never has been. We like to believe in this idea that there was a golden age when everyone supported First Amendment values. And I've looked at a lot of First Amendment cases and a lot of First Amendment history. I'm not sure when that was, based on American history. I think that public support for the right to say unpopular things has always been tenuous. The bargain that we offer to people is that when someone says hateful things, when they shout racial slurs at you or your spouse or your kids, that we're not going to jail them. We're not going to allow you to sue them. But we believe in more speech, and we believe in freedom of association. So you can stop going to that place. You cannot associate with those people. You can talk back to those people. That's the bargain. But if we start to tell people, okay, not only do you have to allow these people to shout obscene epithets at you and say what they're going to do to your kids and use racial slurs at you, all these things that have happened to me on Twitter regarding my kids. Not only are they not going to go to jail, not only is no one going to be able to sue them, but you know what? We've decided the social norm is they just get to do that here. They're not going to be moderated. They're not going to be kicked off. Suck it up. And no reputable social media network is going to do that. Good social media networks let that happen. We're not going to encourage you as a free speech value to go find a different living room, to go find the social media network that has the atmosphere that you like, the one that you choose, to choose to subject yourself to that sort of speech or not, to associate with people like that or not. No, we're going to have as a social norm, not only do you not punish it, you got to just sit there and take it. Are people going to take that bargain? What's the impact of that on the support for the more fundamental norms, the legal norms of free speech? If we start trying to sell people on the concept that, well, sorry, if you like Facebook, you have to like people shouting racial slurs at your kids. That's just the way it is. Do they start to rethink a little bit their support of free speech as an entire norm? If they think, this is kind of bullshit. Because why don't I have free speech? Why don't I get to choose a platform that's the way I like it? Why don't I get to associate with who I want? I think the bargain is essential. The bargain is we allow terrible things. We allow terrible offensive speech. We don't let the government punish it. But we have to allow just as broad responses. And the broad response might be to be unreasonably standoffish, to be unreasonably censorious in your personal voluntary interactions, to associate yourself in a way that other people might not agree with, to be too broad in the people you think are offensive and avoid them. Because there is no rational theory of free speech, I submit, that says you shouldn't judge the Nazi shouters, but you should judge the people who don't want to hang out with them. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. All right, so now we're going to have a couple of minutes of back and forth here. And I'm going to take the moderator's prerogative before you guys give your rebuttals. Just ask a quick question, then we'll go to you guys. Thad, should Jewish Mingle allow Catholics?
First of all, am I still allowed to curse?
Yes.
Okay.
And now you're actually forced. This is the contractual obligation.
No. I thought I made that clear, didn't I? That I want people who don't take my money to do what they want in terms of their own internal rules. And in fact, I encourage that, because Ken's point is actually a very important point. And I think it may have been missed too, that I learned this from him, okay? That imposing a culture of free speech universally is something I really don't like. It's called imperialism, right? So I'm completely with you on that, and we don't disagree on that. I'll go back to you.
one of the questions one of the things you were arguing about is that Twitter, Facebook, and many companies that get tax breaks or incentives should show up at a certain place. They stop being a private entity, and there's something different going on. The Catholic Church, which you said you don't want to tell Catholics what to do.
They take a lot
the
of money.
Catholic Church is the biggest tax break operator ever.
Sorry, I'm still
So why wouldn't you start imposing that the Catholic Church offer sacraments for
Nick,
you?
Nick, I was wrong. I take it back. The Catholic Church should have pure First Amendment rules throughout. No, we should stop giving them our money. Right? I mean, it's similar to the immigration debate, right? I hear about libertarians. It's like, oh, we can't let the immigrants in because of the social welfare state. I'm like, why don't you just let the immigrants in and not let them take the social welfare, or maybe attack the social welfare state instead, right? Because if you're for liberty, you let people cross borders, right?
Okay.
Sorry. I mean, I don't even know if anybody in here has that position, but I've heard it among a lot of libertarians.
Yeah.
So it's very similar, right? We're barking up the wrong tree or something, I think, often. But, yeah. Back to you.
Well, let me... finish the thought. What's the one question you want to ask?
I mean,
I
love you, Ken, and you're a hero, but I think you missed... You lighted that? I don't know. I mean, you lighted that major point I was making about what do we do? And it's a tough question. I'm not saying it's easy, because the Catholic Church is a great example. They take huge amounts of tax breaks, et cetera. What do we do with that? What do we do with these corporations that take not a small amount? I'm talking about billions and billions and billions of dollars. Look it up. Facebook, Twitter, all of them. What do we do when the government, here it is, guys, when the government grants essentially a natural monopoly to the people they like politically? You understand that's exactly what's happening. That's very clear now. This is not some wacky fringe theory here. This is very, very clear now that that's what they're doing. What do you do when the government gives all these subsidies and land and buildings to these corporations for political reasons to put forward a particular political point of view? Are those still just private entities like your living room?
You're solving the wrong problem. So if you're going after the problem that we're subsidizing too much, that there's too much government and private entanglement, the way to solve the problem pro-liberty is not to therefore make all these private entities act more like the government. It's to reduce the subsidies and the government backing and that type of thing. Maybe it's to enforce antitrust law more. Maybe it's to really challenge the tax breaks, which are all the time completely ludicrous. And, you know, social media start talking about sports tax breaks. I don't think, though, that we increase liberty or free speech by letting the government, by subsidizing, control more of the way that private enterprises and private people are.
I think I just happened upon a brilliant libertarian strategy going forward, right? Every time we come across one of these entities, say, hey, do you take my money? You do. Okay, so here's the deal now. You're public. You do what I say. Or you can give me my money back. Catholic Church, Facebook, whoever it is. I mean, I think, in other words, this is not a practical program I'm putting forward here. You know, the great senators in Washington, D.C. are not going to take this up anytime soon. I'm talking about a cultural movement, which is what we all are about here. That's what Reason is about. That's what I'm about. That's what you're about. I think we should start calling, I think we need to, or they're literally going to kill us. I mean, I'm not kidding you. I think they are driving us to World War III with Russia, which is already going on, by the way. That's what it's about. That's why it's so important for them to control Facebook. They are deadly serious about it. Facebook is, this year, the number one funder of the Atlantic Council.
Ken, let me ask you a question. What, you know, you take sometimes we make these distinctions between a platform and a channel. So Twitter, YouTube, Facebook, these are platforms. We don't call them as specific channels. What about something like the Daily Stormer, you know, like a neo-Nazi website? Should they, what if they cannot connect to the website? What if they cannot register through any company that allow, you know, that does registry for the internet? Is that a problem?
I think it is a problem, and the question is how we address it.
Why is the internet then different than Twitter or YouTube or Facebook?
Well, I think you're talking about internet backbone type functions. So hosting, I think, is more in the middle. It's not quite so much crucially backbone. But if you're talking about, like, you know, domain name type stuff, right, where really that controls the entire internet, that tells things where to go. You can tell I'm not technical in the way I'm describing this. There's a real difference, I think. There's a spectrum between my blog on the one side and the companies that, you know, drive where all internet traffic goes on the other. I think that the common carrier arguments that you hear, that some entity should be regulated like the phone company or the electric company or something like that, are probably strongest for things that are completely non-communicative,
just the IP or the address of
the address
of a neo-Nazi site.
Maybe
not even a neo-Nazi site.
Right.
Let's say, you know what? They're actual Nazis. There's nothing new about it, but a Nazi site, right?
Sure. So I think there's a better argument for treating as a common carrier and regulating the way you would the phone company or trains or things like that when you're talking about the genuine, the equivalent of phone lines, right? But I think the closer you get to entities that have a message, that have speech, and that's anywhere very much so on my blog, maybe a little less arguably on Twitter, to some extent something like Bluehost or Dreamhost or one of these branded themed hosts, then I think the further you get down that way, the more they have a First Amendment right themselves to decide who to associate with.
What I want to ask people to do, if you want to ask a question, we have a microphone set up in the back. If you could form a line, and you will, our tech people will help there. So you can either come in from the cold or stand up and go sit in line or stand in line. And Ken, do you have a question for Thad or a point of a rejoinder?
Sure. Thad, let me ask you this. Do you think all speech is equally speech encouraging? So what I mean is this. Do you think that the sort of speech that some platforms like Twitter and Facebook are banning encourages speech or is part of the culture of free speech to promote discourse? Okay. So does the culture of free speech include yelling racial slurs at someone on Twitter? Does that encourage speech?
Does yelling racial slurs encourage speech?
Yeah.
Oh. Obviously. Yes. I mean, because we've had just an absolute volcano of speech in the last 2 years, haven't we? When anyone says anything even slightly racially insensitive, what happens? We get a torrent of speech in response, don't we?
Well, does it encourage the speech of the person who's being yelled at?
It depends on the person.
And as people are lining up, what do you guys make of the fact, too, though, that, I mean, has your experience ever been marred by stupid people on Twitter? in this sense, I mean, your
other than myself,
it's a testimony.
Nick Gillespie, by the way, I think it was yesterday, tweeted, "Wouldn't life be better without Twitter?"
Yes.
So, just for the record, just so you know.
No, but what I'm saying is it's very easy to block people and to mute people and to ignore. I never encountered an Alex Jones video on YouTube unless I went out and sought it out. It's so why are we getting so hot and bothered about all of this ugly speech when it's like one button to get rid of it forever?
I'm not sure it is one button, but yes, there have been occasions when there have been enough swarms of people coming at me when I've annoyed white nationalists, groups like that, where it has genuinely degraded the experience and I've taken a break. Mm-hmm. You know, after they talked about used racial slurs for my daughters and said how they were going to rape them, then yes, that impairs my experience. And I
and this,
might wait, back we're, away
we're
for a
still
while.
Talking about Club Penguin? Yeah.
This time, that was Twitter.
Yeah.
And so, yes, I can block them one by one. It takes a long time. But the way I see it, part of my freedom of association and my choice as a consumer is finding a platform that has a moderation scheme that I can live with. And one, Twitter, I mean, they blocked me for stupid reasons. They block people for stupid reasons. But out of a ton of terrible ones, maybe they're the best. So I think that I like my freedom to choose platforms that have a particular moderating style that I like.
Okay, let's ask a question, please, and make sure it is a question. At least, you know, have intonation rising at the end of your long statement.
I'll try my best.
Go ahead, and if you would give your name as well.
Hi, I'm Darren, and thanks for having this thing tonight. This is great. My first time here. I'm generally a pretty big free markets guy, anti-regulation guy, but I feel like in this day and age, the biggest threat to the free market are monopolies, and it seems that's where we're heading. You know, Disney swallowing up every film studio. You know, these social networks. I feel like, yeah, my gut instinct says, let them do what they want. They're private companies, but like, I'm sorry, I don't know your name, man, but not Ken.
Ken, my name's Ken.
You're what? Not
so
Ken.
What's the question?
Yeah, I just saw. It seems that, like, you even brought up, Ken brought up Gab. You can go to Gab. Gab was shut down just this weekend for having, non-conforming beliefs and because possibly was too far right. And so I'm just wondering, what do you guys think? Like, it seems to me that these other companies, Facebook and Twitter, Instagram, it's not so easy to make up your own company anymore. It's because there's so much money in the other things. So what... Do you really think it's that easy to make up a new company to fight that these days?
No. So Gab and Minds, guess what they don't get? They don't get tax breaks. They don't get free land. They don't get anything from the government. So, again, I'm sorry, but please, after this, just Google Facebook, pick your company, and subsidies, and you'll see. I'm talking tens of billions of dollars of tax breaks. They don't, in the city of San Francisco, Facebook pays $0 in payroll tax. I would like to have that as a business owner. Thank you very much. Competing with them? I am competing with them, right? Gab is competing with them. Minds is competing with them. They don't get those tax breaks. They don't get to have a fancy office in downtown San Francisco for basically free, right? Twitter opened their headquarters in downtown San Francisco 3 years ago. Same deal. Huge tax breaks. No payroll tax, right?
So
it's completely rigged. If you're going to take my money, rig the game so that I can't enter a market, and then tell me what I can and can't say in their monopolies that were created by the government, right? That's the issue. Okay.
So I would say, again, we're solving the wrong problem. The right way to solve that problem is by looking more at antitrust law, whether they are actually monopolies, to go vigorously after all those subsidies and question why people are getting them. But I don't think it's to turn them into something that is government-like. I don't think that that promotes liberty. I also think you have to ask, when you say it's not easy to just go out there and start your own company, you have to ask compared to what? At what point in human history has it been easier for someone disfavored by the government, unpopular with unpopular views, to reach more people? Has there ever been a time when it's been easier for that to happen?
That's exactly why what's happening is happening, because they understand this. This is the freest moment, and they're making sure it will no longer be this free.
Okay, next question.
My name is Thomas. I just was wondering about, you were talking about MySpace. Do you think that's a...
Yeah.
It's on? Oh, sorry. I think that's a poor comparison because they didn't have political power at the time that tech was in its infancy. How are they going to convince a city to give them that much subsidy? And on top of that, you have intellectual property rights, which is another sort of Damocles that they can hold over their competitors' heads, where they can say, hey, you infringed on my idea.
What is the, what's the question?
So my question is, isn't that another layer of collusion with the government to keep out competitors in terms of intellectual property, where they can say, hey, you infringed slightly on my idea, I can launch a lawsuit, and now you don't have the financial means to then defend yourself against this. So essentially, that just puts you out of business as well.
Do you want to address that, or the idea of a large corporation having legal weapons at its disposal?
Or is it really, it's really about IP, right?
IP, yeah.
Yeah, you want to...
Go ahead.
No, I don't. I mean, yes, IP obviously restricts trade, right? I mean, it's obviously you're handing a monopoly to an entity, right? A business entity. It's the same deal. I mean, let me elaborate really quickly on this. I meant to mention also another fairly important entity or institution in our society that's gotten even bigger subsidies than Facebook and Twitter have and Google have, which is the higher education system. Okay, so right when Abraham Lincoln was throwing people in prison for being disloyal, at that very moment, the federal government was hand-giving free land to missionaries, Christian missionaries, who wanted to start colleges. And now we completely fund all the colleges and universities in this country, except for about two, to the gills with the federal student loan program. If we took away all the federal subsidies and state and local subsidies for higher education, there would be about four colleges left in this country. And I can't wait for that day, by the way. But I also, it's the same question, right? So my son, if he goes to college, and he'll be going soon, I will
Does
be in the position.
I
will be on
if he goes, but yeah, he is going.
Well, yeah, I don't know. That's another debate. you know, so I'm in the position of paying quite a bit in taxes, right, for these colleges and universities to support the federal student loan program. Which, by the way, do you know that it makes a profit for the federal government? It's a profitable, and we still pay taxes to support it. Matt Taibbi wrote a great article in Rolling Stone about this. I highly recommend it. So I'm paying all this money for these places where they tell my son he can't say certain things. I'd like my First Amendment back, or I'd like my money back.
Do you agree, then, that if you get a dollar through a student loan, which goes to the student that then goes to a particular university, that university, whether it's private or not, should have to abide by the same rules of speech as a public university?
I'm sort of thinking through this. I think it's a great question. But yeah, basically, I think at least they have to answer to that, don't they? Don't they? I mean, come on, guy. I mean,
I think that, well, to go back to the question, the reference to MySpace or any of the others are not to suggest they were exactly the same. Of course they're not. Times have changed over the last 10, 15 years. The idea is that I don't think we can assume that something that seems like a juggernaut now is still going to be one in the next 10 or 15 years. Politics changes dramatically. Tech changes dramatically. And I think that when you're thinking about having an aim of starting new things to challenge the current juggernauts, you have to take a longer view. And so even if Twitter or Google seem unstoppable now, I'm not sure that's going to be the case in 15 years.
And actually, there is evidence that Twitter and Facebook, at least in North America, are starting to see declines in average daily users or the duration, which may be a sign that they are not that competitive or that they've become cesspools. Okay. But let's go to the next question.
Hi, my name's Tommy. Everybody's had almost the same question as I have, but I will go a little bit further on a couple of these things. For Thad, You have this idea, you're public now, do what I say. The I is always going to be the government, though, because they're the ones that are making the rules.
Yeah, my preference is always to get my money back, by the way, just so I'm clear, right? Right? Yeah. That's our preference, isn't it? Always, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. You get to say whatever you want in your church or your school or your social media, whatever platform, but give me my money back.
Yeah. I do think the subsidies point demolishes the idea or at least puts a big dent in the idea that we don't know what's going to be there in 15 years because it's a huge advantage. For Ken, would the government prosecute and even recognize a monopoly that's created by the government because of the subsidies?
Only if we demand it. Only if people require it. So antitrust prosecutions have gone all over the place. I mean, look, right now, the subject of going after Twitter or Google or Facebook on antitrust grounds is popular in some circles for political reasons, from the right because they are perceived as on the left. And indeed, I think a lot of the talk about how these social networks are improperly restricting speech is politically driven. So Thad has views that they are assisting one spectrum and, you know, pro-war, that type of thing. I think the way it's being spun now, at least in Congress, is very much a right versus left. The notion that to fight against the liberals and all these people, we have to take these back for real Americans who, you know, don't live on this coast or the other coast, but live in the middle. So, but to go back to your question, antitrust prosecutions have come and gone with the political winds. They can change again, and if you make it enough of an issue, as some people are trying to do on the specific issue, then yes, you could have more.
I just want to say one thing about that. Another warning flag, if I haven't scared you enough tonight. The response by the few people on the left who are interested in this, who are just as outraged for the same reasons that I am, unfortunately, their answer is, what do you think? Make social media public utilities. Which is a great way, of course, to open up speech and, you know, expand the Overton window and everybody can say, right, it's exactly the worst possible idea, more government control. But so be warned that that's coming down the pike too. So, and in antitrust, real quickly, and I really am done, being a historian again, the great, great, great Marxist historian Gabriel Kolko showed pretty definitively that antitrust was a scam always, and that without regulation by the government, this is a Marxist talking, okay, competition flourished, and that it was actually intervention by the government in antitrust cases at the turn of the 20th century that caused the consolidation of capital. So it is far from clear that antitrust will get us anything we want, and think about the people who will be wielding those lawsuits. Mm-hmm. That's the thing, right? Have you watched, you know, who the senators and stuff are recently, right? I mean, that's who would be doing this. Do you think Cory Booker and Kamala Harris and that jackass from Alabama really are just going to, like, be neutral and let us have our free speech and they're not going to use it for political purposes? Give me a break.
Let's go to the next question.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jack. And so this question, I guess, is primarily for Thad. But in the case of, say, someone like Alex Jones, who blatantly and openly disseminates false information and encourages harassment against multiple groups of people, what obligation do social media companies have to, I don't know, do they have an obligation to keep that sort of speech in the interest of free speech, or is there a line that can be drawn at all in terms of what, like, social media companies?
No, they need to kill Alex Jones, clearly, because he constitutes a threat, because his words hurt us. So this is another thing we need to talk about, right? Why on earth does hate speech hurt anyone? Why does it need to hurt anyone? Must we be hurt by other people's words? I submit to you, no, we don't have to. I submit to you, even if I were a Sandy Hook parent, I wouldn't need to be upset by what the stupidest person in public life says about my child's death. Right? Alex Jones, last time I saw him, was yelling literally at a pile of shit in Texas. Okay, that's all I know about the guy. I mean, literally. Literally. You seen the video? Yeah. Okay.
So, no mirror was available.
So I, whatever Alex Jones says about me or my son or anything, like, it's just hilarious to me. And you don't, and I've been, so for, I was going to say, for about a year and a half now, I've had about 1.5 million men screaming at me because I said that I don't believe in truth on a podcast once. Okay. It's every single day. They call me pussy. They call me faggot, 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 pussy, pussy, faggot, faggot, cuck, 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 faggot, pussy, pussy, fag, cuck, cuck, cuck. 20, 30, 50, 100 times a day for a year and a half, okay? I know what it's like. It's like these people are gnats to me. It's annoying when there's 1,000 gnats around you, but a gnat is a gnat, right? And we need to interrogate this thing about why we're necessarily hurt by certain words said by people.
Can I ask, what about something like doxing, or if people were sending stuff to your address, if they were telling people publicly where you live?
Well, then I kill them. What? That's how that works.
Okay.
Yeah, so, okay. I mean, that, no, and I kind of mean that. Like, you know, I mean, I think personal, that's a matter of personal safety, right? And I'm kind of for privatizing personal safety and security, frankly, aren't we? Kind of in this room a little bit? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if you dox me, good luck with that. Good luck with that.
Ken?
I'm just going to hand you my card now in case anything.
He is a defense lawyer. So how about the next?
I respond to that question, actually?
Thank you, Ken. I will be needing it soon.
My answer to you is I think that my opinion is that social media has a moral obligation there, but not a legal one, as long as they're keeping within the bounds of the First Amendment and Section 230, which is the one that generally makes them invulnerable to lawsuits for the content of stuff like that. That said, I want a system where I make moral choices about which social media I use based on how they make moral choices. I want a system where I choose or don't choose Facebook or Twitter or anything else based on them doing that, just like everyone else. And our collective moral choices make different approaches rise or fall. And I have to argue a little bit with that on this whole thing about why do words hurt us? Hell, I don't know. But to me, the idea, why do you let words hurt you, is no more of an apt question, why do you feel you have to use those words? I leave that up to people. I decide I don't let the government regulate it through criminal law or through defamation law or things like that, when it's words like that. But I don't want to tell people how they should feel about words, and I generally don't want to tell them what words to use. So I don't think we should order society that way.
I'm clearly right. I did not say how you should feel. I'm just saying you don't necessarily need to feel particular things about particular things. That's all.
Let's next question.
My question is a slight extension of your debate question, but I think there are a lot of similar arguments on both sides. Should PayPal and companies like that stop processing payments for websites that host hate speech and all kinds of bad speech, or should they have a neutral policy?
Who wants to take that first?
Sure. I mean, this is a question to me that's, you know, is PayPal, what is it like? What is it? Is it more like a bank? Do we let banks choose who to do business with or not do business with? This is actually a live question. Some banks are deciding not to do business with gun manufacturers or the NRA because of their political beliefs. So do we want to start regulating that? I don't think so. Do we want to have a social norm that banks or PayPal or any of those don't make decisions based on politics? Again, rather than a broad social norm, I like us voting with our feet and saying, if PayPal pisses me off because they start processing something I like, then I stop using them, and I encourage others to stop using them. But I don't think that you can have a universal broad social norm that entities like that should never decide to stand up for what they believe in.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's just an extent. Well, you sort of said it's an extension of the question, but it's also an extension of the answer, I think, right? So, yeah, I think. I mean, I kind of want to know where PayPal's offices are in San Francisco and exactly, you know, how they get. Yeah. But
I'm sure that they've gotten more than their.
I'm sure they've very
more
friendly
subsidies than the
very
the
friendly with the board of supervisors up there. Yeah, but so yeah.
Great. Next question.
Hi there. My name is Aaron. Hi. How are you?
Hi.
So I'm wondering. I had another question, then I heard an answer a minute ago that now I had to quickly change the question because Anyway, so I'm wondering what actions do you think individuals can take to move closer toward a culture of communication and listening, and as opposed to censorship, whether it's self-censorship or censorship of others, what actions could we take to move closer toward that? And for example, could some of those actions be to proactively ask and engage in conversation with people of different views?
Great okay. question.
Yep.
And it's something it's something I deal with once a week. You know what I mean? So not once a week, but many weeks on my show, on my podcast. You know, I've had many, many people whose politics are radically different than mine. And what I try to do, I don't know how successful I am always, but my intention is to model the behavior I would like to see others take, right? Which is to simply be open to the ideas. But here's the important thing. Here's the important thing that liberals don't do and civil libertarians often don't do. Challenge them. Be comfortable in conflict. Be comfortable with intellectual and political conflict. And that's where Americans are just babies. We're just tiny little babies. When we have the littlest conflict, we start screaming and crying and freaking out, and we got to run away, right? That's Twitter. that's political discourse in this country. So what I try to model is that, you know, it's like, no, I think what you just said actually is racist, but let's talk about it, right? Or, huh, that sounds an awful lot like fascism, what you're advocating. Or, gee, do you really want to nationalize the television industry? You know, talk about it, have the conflict, state exactly where I stand on this, but hear it out. Hear it out. See, here's the thing. Be curious about your enemies. Be curious about your enemies.
Okay. Ken?
That is 100% right. I couldn't say any better. I think what we're lacking a lot is the combination of worthwhile discourse that's not just screaming obscenities to each other, but really genuinely challenging the ideas on the other side. And I interact with a lot of people I strongly disagree with on issues, and I think I learn the most and get the most out of it when I have that kind of discussion, when we genuinely argue about, but, you know, in a friendly, civil way, up to a point, about the points that we're making.
It's actually patronizing, I think, and disrespectful to not challenge people. Okay, so I've been in college campuses for my entire adult life, and this is, ask a black person who's been a student or a faculty member on a college campus, and I'll bet you anything they will tell you they get patronized all the damn time because that's what goes on, right? If they say something that the rest of the faculty disagrees with, they don't get any pushback. I've seen this happen 1,000 times. A black person gets up, I know that there's disagreement, and no one contradicts them because they're scared to do that, right? That ends up treating the black person like a child. It puts us in the position of being their parents or taking care of them. We're worried that they're going to be hurt. Their feelings are going to be hurt. So we take it upon ourselves to protect the poor, vulnerable black person, right? And that's the way I think political discourse generally operates. It's the baby and the adult. So the baby starts screaming and crying, and half the adults want to take care of the baby, and half the adults want to keep yelling at the baby. Right? That's what
no,
I see.
I just want to point out, I think you just figured black people as babies. And that's kind of racist.
Wait, no, I'm saying that's how they are treated. Okay. Yes, okay, yes.
So this is going to be the last, we have time for one last question.
Really, really quick.
No, you cannot. I'm sorry, no, you cannot. Thank you. This is our platform, but thank you. Okay, final
just
question.
Just yell fire, everyone will leave.
Hi, my name's Heidi. I have a question for Ken. Can you hear me?
I sure can.
So my question for you is that the problem with your argument is that it's a slippery slope and that they're going to decide where hate speech ends, and then it might end up including all conservative speech and all libertarian speech, and that's kind of dangerous. And there are a lot of impressionable minds on Facebook, and that's kind of scary.
Sure they might, because people are idiots. So, but that would be their speech. That would be their freedom of association. And the whole point is that we don't regulate people's speech and freedom of association. When we have this model where we vote with our feet, where we go to different platforms that are run the way we like, that have the type of atmosphere we like, that have the moderation style that we like, some of them are going to be absolutely terrible. some of them are going to be terrible in the other direction. They're going to allow, you know, there's a whole lot of very scary stuff that comes short of true threats inciting violence. Some of them are going to be, I think some people call them, you know, Care Bear worlds, where only the most completely inoffensive, safe speech is permitted. But the marketplace of ideas is always going to have bad results and cesspools of various types. And I think the way you deal with that is not by creating this norm where everyone should deal with speech the same way, everyone should moderate the same way, but, you know, let the thousand flowers bloom. And let's choose the platforms that have the moderation approaches that meets our individual needs.
Okay. We are going to go to our final summary statements. And Thad, would you like to, you have the podium for 5 minutes to sum up your ideas.
Wow, totally unprepared. I want your questions. I want your comments. I don't know. What do you think? Did I do it? Did I win? Like what? I mean, I don't know. I think I gave you everything I got here. I mean, do you want to hear more about subsidies? Is that sexy? You want dollar amounts? I don't have them. They're in the billions. I can tell you that. Yeah. It's a I guess what I'm saying is here that I am trying to introduce a new conversation. Okay. I don't have all the precise answers. I have a lot of answers for myself, right, about my money and my rights and all that stuff. I don't have the answers for you, but I do think we have to start asking different questions and thinking about this differently and having different conversation. So I interviewed Nadine Strossen, the great, great civil libertarian hero, Nadine Strossen, former president of the ACLU, as good as it gets on this, right? She did not know the direct connection between wartime conscription and restrictions on speech by the Supreme Court. She wasn't aware of that history. And then I started looking into it, and I found out that a lot of very famous civil libertarians like her are simply unaware of that very important thing. That's the one thing the government will not allow us to say. That has always been the only thing. Yates, 1957, Yates decision, 58, right, okay. I bracketed it. The Yates decision left the Holmes's clear and present danger doctrine in there. They didn't touch that part. You can't say when we go to the next, when we're at war with Russia and they're calling for a draft because they need that many troops on the ground to take over all that territory. That's a lot of territory in Asia, right? We will never be able to say, you can't take my son. They've never allowed us to say, you can't take my son. That's the fire. That's the fire. I don't know. I'm pretty, you know, it means a lot to me, right? My son's 17, right? Going to college, and he could be going to somewhere else pretty soon. So this is urgent for me, and I want to have a different conversation. I got nothing else for you. Just vote for it.
I'm going to push back on what they are ever going to allow. We are, in terms of the law, about the best place the First Amendment's ever been. The last couple of decades in First Amendment law have been more free speech protective on the law and what the government can do than any other time in the First Amendment's history. Time and time again, the Supreme Court has pushed back against the idea that the government can regulate things because they're offensive, even very offensive, that the government can set the terms for what categories are or aren't protected. In every way, the government has steadily attempted to censor more, and the Supreme Court has pushed back. You've even heard a lot of complaints from the left that I think the term is weaponizing free speech, that now this is straying into areas of the economy, and that's not right. We only wanted to do it for, you know, the stuff we wanted to talk about. So I don't share right now the concern that the law is going to get more censorious, because the trend's in the other direction, and there are none of the signs in those decisions suggesting that it's slowing down or going the other way. I mean, when the Supreme Court says 8-1 that you can stand outside a military funeral and say God loves dead Marines and things like that, then I think we're getting pretty far along the way. What we do have, though, is a continuing debate and disagreement about what I called bullshit, the culture of free speech. How do we want to deal with each other? How do we want to interact with each other? What's right and what's wrong, and how should we regulate it socially? And what I'm trying to say is this, that the best way is always going to be that marketplace of ideas and voting with your feet and deciding not to shut down that person you can't stand, but maybe not go out with your friends when they're part of the group. I think that we have to take a second look, like Thad says, at what we think is speech or isn't, what we think expression is or isn't. You might notice that there's this trend towards saying all these people are, you know, against free speech when they do things that are very much free speech. You get that with the governments and states trying to pass laws making it legal to run over people who are blocking the roads during protests. You see it in a spate of laws that are getting struck down, with state governments saying that you can be kicked out of school if you heckle a speaker. These are things that are trying to reclassify dissent against dissent, dissent within the discussion, as being illegitimate. And there is a philosophical attempt there, too, to say that when you say, you know, you're a racist asshole, that somehow that is on a different speech level than being a racist asshole. I don't think that it is. I think that our decision to speak out with more speech, to call people out for things we think are terrible, to decide not to associate with them, that that is just as core to free speech as what they are saying in the first place. It's what I call the first speaker problem. This idea that we're only concerned with the first person who starts speaking and whether or not the reaction will deter or chill that person. Well, what about the second speaker? What about the person who reacts? Sometimes these social media networks are that second speaker. They are making decisions, both, I think, mercenary and heartfelt, about what kind of mini societies they want to be running and making money off of. And I think that that speech, that association act, is just as legitimate as the ones of the people who want to speak on them. Thank you.
All right, let's give a big extra round of applause for both Thad and Ken. And I want everybody now to go back to SohoVote.com to do the post-debate vote, and then we're going to have some uncomfortable moments of impromptu patter while we calculate. So the proposition is, like universities, social media platforms such as Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube should only remove speakers and participants who are making truth threats or inciting violence. You can make your final vote. I've forgotten what I voted at this point. Yeah. Okay, so, and while we do that, Ken, you were almost arrested today. What laws did you break?
I discovered that I had accidentally neglected to renew my driver's license.
Yeah, it's on.
And I discovered that when the police pulled me over. And so...
Do cops go after lawyers with special glee, do you think?
They do, and that's why you genuinely do not want to tell them you're a lawyer. So I did the things that I've been trained to do, which is put my hands on the wheel, ask for permission to reach for my wallet, do all the things that cops have told me make them feel warm and fuzzy and safe. And at the end of the encounter, since I had acted deferentially to them, they let me off with a ticket and didn't tow my car.
Thad, have you? When's the last time you were arrested?
I've been in handcuffs. Three times?
No, I said arrested. Oh. We're not talking about your personal life.
I thought that was just between the two of us. But anyway.
I put it up on Twitter.
It's okay, man. It's okay.
It went viral.
It's okay. I'm a little bit of a leather boy. You know what I mean? Anyway. that just went right. What was the question?
When's the last time you were arrested?
The last time? Well, I've never. I was arrested. Oh, okay. Arrested. I was put in handcuffs 7 years ago, but I was arrested in 1991. Guess why?
Gulf War?
For running onto the Bay Bridge to block it to protest the Gulf War.
Wow.
Yeah, it was stupid.
That's
but, you know, I cut myself a little slack because the cause was just. But, yeah, that was the last time.
That was a very popular war, too.
It was. Not in San Francisco, though.
Yeah.
Not too popular there. Yeah. We caused a lot of trouble.
So now we are getting the final results to the proposition. Again, the proposition was, like university social media platforms such as Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube, and Club Penguin, should only remove speakers and participants who are making true threats or inciting violence. The original vote was 53% agreed that they should only remove speakers who are, making threats or inciting violence. And the no vote was 25%. Afterwards, the yes vote went to 43%, which is a change of minus 10, and the no vote went up to 46-47%. So that means that Ken won by gaining 20% of the votes.
Well done.
All right. So I want to thank you all for coming out to the first West Coast SoHo Forum. Thank you so much.